Just coming back to the heart of all this again, right? This fundamental thing where the fool both returns and reemerges. So we return, what we return into is this place of pure awareness. I am and I will be. So that sense of being and that sense of openness of being, which then steps into Chokmah and steps into the place of duality, the place of reflection and dialogue, that then manifests through Bina as the generation of dialogues, the generation of conversations. So we get the three-way, the basically triangular process that, passing through the prism of Da'at, then creates the expansion of Gedula that is balanced by the contraction of Gebura, that finds balance and then multiplies its energies in Netzach and Hod, creates the living images of Yesod and come into actual concrete expression in Malkut. Now that's the fundamental practice of the tree. And therefore, when we're looking at this angle, this particular path, what we're looking at in particular is that act of emergence, that act of creative witnessing, and the openness that remains in that, the openness to what is going to arise. That's kind of image of the fool about to step off, or about to fall, or will the fool be caught or fall, will it crash? That kind of uncertainty. That kind of, you know, that the image of the weaver in the mound, who is between life and death, but who is connected to everything, and therefore connected to, is, you know, is she about to take a next breath? When will she take a next breath? When is there life? When is there death? So that entering into that place of profound ambiguity, and being able to be at one with that. That's what allows the next thing to happen. That's the footsteps of the fool. That's the next thing, and then the next thing, and then the next thing. And if we think for a moment, you know, about the we're at this level of the tree, we're at fundamentals, we're at simplicities. But these simplicities, of course, are deeply connected to the complexity of our life and everyday life. So that sense of that, you know, witnessing, being present, that first step of just being present. Notice your body. Notice your breath. Here I am. So when I'm here I am, I'm with me and with everything else. My senses, notice the candle, notice you're all sitting there, notice the heat in the room, notice the airflow, hear the sound outside. So here I am with everything. It's a bit much, really, to be honest.
And what you're thinking and what you're feeling, too.
That also, of course, everything. Thoughts, feelings, ideas, memories. Boom, 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 what's going to happen next? What am I going to talk about next? Where are we? How long have we got left? Half an hour. Oh my God, half an hour. Have we got enough time? Too much time? All that, right? And then, so we can do anything. We can go off in any direction. But if we come back to again, okay, I am. Right, so come back to being. Here I am. Now what? Either something happens from outside me or within me. Something happens. Follow the next thing. Let's see where that goes. Let's see what happens next. Now that's that edge of the abyss thing. That's that bit of, hey, okay, we know what's going to happen. Okay, let's jump. Or let's stay back.
So where does being come in this?
Well, being is this. That's the point. Being is, being is this place. It is this trembling on the edge place.
Right, okay.
Well, that's exactly it. Where we'd be, where
a still place, isn't it? It seems like a still place. Like I'm not thinking so much, not feeling so much, not listening so much. Just stop.
Yes, But when you stop, you notice movement. That's the simultaneous experience. It's still and moving. That's exactly it. It's both.
Separate. It's when you're centered rather than still. Is it still centered that you're moving?
Well, if you're in center, you're also in circumference. Mm. Right? Yeah. It's both. Right? Stillness and movement. So if you're going to be still, you notice movement. Mm. If you're going to be centered, you notice the center and circumference. These are just different words for similar experience, I think. So it's the simultaneous nature of duality and the absence of any privacy. In an interconnected universe, there is no privacy. There is continual multi-level conversation. As you sit there, your cells are talking to each other, your nervous system is talking to you, there's a huge raft of conversations supporting your presence just here and just now. And hopefully those conversations are in balance, so you remain being able to sit here and function and communicate with us. If any of those conversations go out of balance at that level, well, actually you may not be here. Or your ability to participate here becomes different. So we've got about 25 minutes left. Let's just see if there's anything else that needs asking or winding up before the weekend comes to an end.
A couple of things that might
go.
Not the right time. Probably both too quick. We always come back to body.
Yeah.
And yet, when we leave this body,
yeah,
we won't have a body.
We won't. Well, we don't know what we'll have.
We
won't have this body, no.
This body.
Definitely not. No.
So there's something about that anchoring into the senses, knowing that at some time that's not what we'll be anchoring into.
That's right.
So that's not really a question, it's just paradox.
Well, it is that, but again, it takes us right into the unknown, doesn't it? Because actually, the senses are some level all we have, and yet, of course, we know that in death the senses cease to exist, which is why it takes us into the profound and knowing nature of death. Now, my own limited experience of talking to beings who are in a different dimension. They certainly act as though they have some sort of body, and certainly their senses are not like mine, for sure. But there is some way of sensing and feeling that they appear to have. But of course, we don't know what that is, because we only know what we have, and anything we interpret, including are they real, am I perceiving something that's real, or is it Ian's fantasy anyway, is another, that's all part of the contemplation. But I think that, of course, is part of the genuine paradox of death, the mystery of death, is that profound not knowing. So that how, if I continue after death, Well, I've no idea how I will continue, because all the ways of knowing I have are based on having this body. So yeah, I think it's an important question, really. I think what helps is that sense that we do have, though, of subtle experience. If we have no sense of subtle experience, I think that's a more problematic situation. So if, as may be the case, that what we find happening is our sense of, if you like, material world vanishing, but a sense of deeper participation in a subtle energetic world. If at least we have some sense of that in life, then that's likely to help us in whatever transition is there.
This is when you get into sort of the rainbow body,
yeah,
that territory.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah. So that idea of the body of light, of subtle, of working with the deep imagination in that way. So whatever sense we have of being able to exist in that dimension is likely to help us in the moment where the body senses stop functioning, I think.
So sorry, the other question was,
yeah,
listening to spirit and listening to spirits, basically singularity versus multiplicity.
And that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because there is, so that sense of, so when we talk about spirit or divine or higher self, or where we're relating to something that does feel singular, does feel bigger or root of everything. And then there's this other sense of subtle beings, want of a better word, spirits as opposed to spirit. So now, as long as I can remember, some of my very earliest memories are of having this sense. I would go into this still shining blackness inside myself, in which I would sort of feel held by something enormous. And there would be, I would feel both in time and outside time, and I would somehow talk to this, or it would talk to me, never in words, but in sort of felt sense of being surrounded by that kind of presence. And that's almost like my most fundamental experience of life, almost. That's the place, I guess, I come back to all the time. But the other experience I had from being relatively young was this sense of people who aren't there, to put it in people nobody else could see. So I have this experience as a child of when I'm falling asleep of what appears to be a Roman soldier sort of looking after me and just is almost watching over me. And I try and tell people about it, and you know, it's your imagination, Ian. And then later on, I have other experiences of people who aren't there, you know, who are kind of, we're living in an old house, and very old house, very dilapidated old house. And there's a sense of an old woman who in this dilapidated cottage next to, and I try and tell people about that, but she's not there, and she seems to be wanting some help, and I have a conversation with her, and I seem to help her in some way by, I don't know, her somehow recognizing that this is not her time or not her place. And then periodically during my life, you know, because this becomes something, this is just part of my life, so I don't talk about it very much, no, because people think you're nuts. You know, so I encounter these people who are existing in some other dimension. Now that's different from that experience of their deep sense of presence, which really feels vast. When I'm talking with spirits, they're people, just like, you know, talking to people here, and they've got good qualities and difficult qualities, but they've got much more distinct sense of personality. And often there's a need, there's some reason why that conversation is happening. It's because something needs sorting out, or help is needed, or they want to help me do something, or give me some information, you know. One of the most extraordinary experiences I had was not actually about a dead person. It was, I was in this is many years ago in university. This is in the early days of getting to know Tom. And I remember I'd been doing the middle pillar exercise, and I centered my attention in Ketta. And I decided to see, can I talk to Tom? Because, you know, I was young, I was experimenting. Can I talk to Tom right now? Okay, so I centered myself in Ketta, and I asked Tom a question. And this only ever happened once, because I think I was a bit freaked out by it and didn't do it again. And it was about like this wind swept into the room. And there was Tom and I had a conversation. And he answered my, I can't remember what the question was, to be quite honest, but he answered my question. And I checked it out with him later, and it was right. And he'd had this sense of me being there. And so this was and I've never had that happen again. So it's not like I'm telepathic or anything. I'm not. But that again was it was more freaky in some ways, because Tom was an actual physical person. I was used to the people who aren't there. That was like part of my world. The idea that Tom could talk to me out of nowhere, and I could get a question answered, and this is in a day, you know, I didn't long before mobile phone, so I couldn't say, you know, so when I checked the answer out later, I didn't write to know what he thought, and he had this sense of me, and he'd thought back a response at me. So something very odd had happened there. But I suppose the difference between these two domains here, the one is the domain of the deep spirit, our relationship to our soul, to the divine. And the other is a sense of relationships in subtle worlds. Yeah. And so, of course, they're related, but in some ways quite different, I think, really.
I suppose, sorry, I'm taking time, but
yeah, no.
The thing that I'm probably wondering is, how to ask for help. I've heard people talking about asking the Great Spirit, which is foreign to me because it's not.
Yeah, I wouldn't be my own.
Brought up thinking about, but that idea of, you know, what, like you were saying about the guy who was struggling with alcoholism and just ask for help.
I think that's the most profound way. I mean, that's more my so I don't know about Great Spirit, because that isn't my idea either. But I think that sense of asking for help, just calling out for help. I mean, the great Christian mystic who wrote The Cloud of Unknowing recommends help as one of the great prayers, where you just center in your heart and you just call out for help, and it's that openness to receiving help from whatever, what the mystery, the divine, the whatever word we give to that, that enables that possibility, really. So yeah, that's and that works for me much better than ideas like be foreign ideas. I think the thing about, we're talking about something very intimate when we talk about this. Mm-hmm. So it's in a way an idea that comes out of another culture or that doesn't feel something I can easily relate to, makes it quite difficult for me to either ask for help or receive help at that level, I think.
It's also any phrase or word attached to it is sort of diminishing it, making it fit into a particular box, because you have got associations around whatever word you use, you know.
But that isn't always bad, though, because sometimes it's kind of helpful. So when I was asking for help from Tom, yeah. I wanted help from Tom. I got help from Tom. But, you know, so sometimes I think the key thing, more important thing, it's not that the ideas around this are wrong, but they have to feel like your own. I think if I think of the guy who has cried out for help, he had no religious beliefs at all and was very skeptical about that. So, of course, he couldn't ask for help from a particular form. In my case, when I do ask for help, I do think of that shining blackness, because that's the sort of, I still don't know what it is, right? But it's something I can relate to, and it helps me to call towards that, whatever that is.
Was that presence strong enough to keep you connecting with spirit beings, even though people around you were saying? Or did you have some kind of support that kept that kind of thing alive?
Well, not when I was young, no. I mean, it didn't shut down. It didn't shut down. It sporadically, I didn't tell people about it. Um, good for obvious reasons. So no, it, you know, it always stayed with me, and you know, I mean, I can remember Ali and I talking about it when we were just friends in our teens, and so I would talk about it. I mean, partly it was also the 70s, so you could as the late 60s kicked in, it became possible to start talking about these things, yeah. Right? Not in my early childhood and in the Welsh village, although, you know, I certainly remember starting out in the village, my long hair and my Buddha amulets and all the rest, but it was supported by that shift in the culture. But even there, very easily have said to people, "I see people out there who aren't there," or "I talk to dead people."
No, but just to carry on, in spite of like everyone around you saying it's rubbish, it must be a strong part of your mission in life to keep that going, because it can be easily shut down.
Well, I suppose I guess it could be, but I guess it was a very fundamental part of my experience of life. I mean, that was one of the really great things for me about getting to know my friend David Spangler, who has it in spades more than I do, actually. So David has much more connection to the world of spirit than I and always had, you know. And one of the great things when David and I are talking, we can just sort of relax and just talk in an uncensored way about our experience and sort of compare our experiences. You know, I mean, they're very different. I mean, David had a much happier childhood than I had, and that gives me some advantages and some disadvantages, and vice versa. But I think if it's fundamentally, and you can't really get away from it. I mean, you could, but it would have done me enormous damage to pretend. And I suppose I was lucky when I was 18 that I came across Tom Ullman, really, and Ernest Butler. Because then I'm in a different ballgame. Then I'm talking to people who can help me. In a particular, and I don't want to give any of the wrong impression, I had lots of delusion as well about all this. So lots of fantasy about my abilities as well as, and so I needed a lot of help to determine, well, what is true and what is just my fantasy, you know, so obviously I was lucky in finding people who could help me to do that.
My daughter was very young. She used to see people and talk to them, and she'd tell me certain things. And then as she got older, she decided she didn't want that anymore. So she stopped.
Yeah, no people can do that. Yeah.
And now she's older, she's in her 30s, she's kind of gradually can see it's coming back. So it's never gone away.
No, I wonder.
But she sort of decided, no, I don't want this. It's too disturbing.
No, I can completely understand that, particularly when you're opening up into young life and you want to put your attention somewhere else. But of course, because it is there, it's interesting, I think, that as she comes into her 30s and presumably her life is stabilised in whatever way it is, so because that's naturally part of her, she will start noticing things again. I don't think you can really get rid. You can shut them down. You can dislike, like anything in your life. You can decide, I'm not going to cultivate that side of my being, which means it doesn't go away, but it remains dormant. But if your attention swings back to it again, of course it starts to come back to life, really. So what do you guys do about perceiving spirits? What happens to you? When do you see spirits?
I've not had that kind of experience.
So you've never sensed somebody with you in a room or some... No, I don't mean distinct, but do you ever have a sense of just somebody being with you?
Five in a place where the building feels all right on, not that kind of.
Because it's important to say that, and actually David would also say this, I don't have powerful visual images, I have felt senses of people. Images will come into my mind later. But very often, I think most people experience spirits, I'm honest with you. If you pay attention, I think you will discover you do. But what you will, but because we've got conventional ways of thinking about what that would involve, we often disregard our perceptions.
That idea of being scared because of, not that your daughter's because of visions, but the idea of like lying in bed and thinking, oh, there could be beings around me.
Yeah.
And then almost like trying to tune into that visually, not trying to, but being aware that there's mm-hmm. potential to tune into that visually.
Yeah.
I think that is probably, for me, a reason why I probably would shy away from that.
Yeah, sure.
Rather than just sitting with the with yeah. sort of more felt sense.
Yeah.
Because if you're more visual, you can't really help yourself but go to.
Yeah.
Also, what is it? You know, what shape is it? What? Is this a snake? This is a.
Yeah, that's right.
And then you're in.
Yeah.
Less.
Well, I think that's right. That's the trouble. Then you then start to, your mind starts to spin, right? And I think that then does frighten you, and then you kind of, whereas actually if we're thinking of, one of the ways to think about this is that we are in a subtle field of connections, and we have choice about whether we connect, just like in every life, choice whether to say hello to somebody or not. But so if we're aware of that subtle field, if there is a sense of people, we've still got control. If we want to say hello to somebody, we can. If we don't, we don't. But there's something about allowing that, just that sense of possibility, and then getting curious about what gets perceived. And very often, the beginning of that isn't just what you said, Rob, about sensing an atmosphere in a place. Building feels like a good place, a happy place, or a sad place, or a depressing place, a warm place, a cold place.
I can actually say, I have very, very often known I've got a client inquiry, felt that presence.
Yeah.
And within a couple of days there'll be an email.
Yeah, exactly. That's the sort of thing. Yeah.
So that happens quite a lot.
Yeah.
And and very often I'll have a sense of what a client's going through. Especially if it's something interpersonal,
yeah.
I'll have a sense of that.
Okay.
And know that, and especially with some more borderline territory, I had a client a while ago, really having quite dynamic, sort of energetic conversations within sleep or whatever. So I certainly have that sort of experience, but
okay.
Not knowing the dead.
Well, the thing is, well, I mean, it doesn't have to be the dead. It can be people who are just the trouble is, the word dead. We sound like we're in resonance. So it is literally sensing presences, right?
Yeah.
So we don't.
In the phone ringing, you go, oh, I know who that is.
Yeah. Right, but the thing is, you're allowed to think that because that's a normal thing. That's considered to be a normal aspect of intuition. Sensing people who aren't there. Physically there, is considered to be the preserve of crazy people or mystics or something abnormal. Okay, so I suspect that for many of us, we just screen that out. We don't kind of, for all kinds of reasons, we don't pay attention to it, or we dismiss it swiftly and automatically. So I guess what I'm suggesting in the last 10 minutes really is consider that you may actually be much more aware of people who aren't there than you think you are. And it doesn't have to be a frightening thing. But it's something you can just be gently curious about.
For instance, if someone's died. Like I think of Julian now.
Yeah.
I know Julian very well. But I could picture him, and I know he's a big Christian.
Okay.
And I go, oh, is this okay for you? We talked about you today. But so I've
okay, so right now, Andy, right now. Reach out in your awareness towards Julian. Okay. And just see what happens when you just reach out to him. See what you perceive.
A tentative hand coming up.
Okay, good.
Like that.
Right, good. So trust that.
Mm.
Believe that.
Yes, I can feel the heart heartfeltness of that.
Yes, exactly. That's what we're talking
about. You're also sitting here, so is the group. So that
of course, well, you've got the support, right? So that, but that means you, because you're here and we're talking about it and we're saying, oh, yeah, give it a go, that it just encourages you to believe yourself, to trust your perceptions, right? And that's the thing we all need. We need that kind of encouragement to trust our perceptions.
Hardest thing, because I don't see anything, even though I'm really visual.
No, I don't either.
I get a sense of knowing, and
that's
I
right.
just know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But then that doubt can come really quickly. Right.
Totally.
So that's the.
Yeah, so that's the dance, right? That's what we're working with. And sometimes that doubt is right because we've misperceived something. Sometimes it's entirely wrong.
I think there's sometimes other senses as well, aren't there? I know sometimes I've had a sense of Bill Gray's presence. And that's come accompanied by the smell of a paraffin heater. But I don't see him, but I get the smell of the paraffin.
Yes, exactly that. Yeah,
and
totally.
Like, even when the paraffin heater isn't there, you can smell it.
Yeah,
there's
no paraffin
here.
Heater there.
Oh, right, that's your signal is here.
But yeah, well, no, I get it. I get the presence, but that kind of comes
with it.
With it.
Yeah.
Because I spent hours sitting with him in his study and
I remember that paraffin heater
actually.
I remember that. But that of course is really accurate, of course, isn't it? Because that's, you know, smell is such a powerful thing, and it brings you right back into sitting with Bill.
Yeah.
So that, of course, that's a signature almost.
Yeah.
You know,
confirmation in a way. It's that.
Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No, totally.
And so if you do perceive something which frightens you, is it advisable to bring in some other presence which is loving and wise and, you know, to hold you and them?
It kind of depends, right? So it depends if the presence appears malignant, I would close your senses down and just push them away. Okay, depends what you're in touch with, and it depends how the effect on you. Sometimes there is a difficult presence, but you feel like you want to bring in an angel, an archangel, or a guide of some kind. Well, that can be helpful. But it's really very much a question of what, like any other relationship. You know, meet a difficult person in the street. Sometimes we would get somebody to help us with it. Other times we would just avoid them completely and withdraw. And it's very much that kind of discrimination, I think.
Might just be the fear of the experience rather than something
Yes, it is. Well, exactly, yeah. Yeah, so it may not be malignant. You may just be scared because actually it's an unusual experience. And in a certain sense, the more you get used to your own inner senses operating, the less scared you get, in my experience, really. So the more you can just trust your direct perception. Genuinely malignant presences are incredibly rare. Right. You do come across lost and disturbed souls sometimes, but the kind of things that I've written about in that book haven't happened to me very often in my life, and fortunately.
I'm getting quite a disturbing. I sort of my mother and father. Father's quite a peace energy with that. But my mother's energy, I don't want to engage with at all.
Oh, that's fine.
It feels like it wants to. It's too needy. It wants me to. And I'm kind of feeling quite sort of agitated.
Right, well, again, it's just important to remember you don't have to engage with anything that you don't want to.
Mm.
You have complete sovereignty over your experience.
Mm.
Let's stop it there, because it's a big topic, and we're at the end. So let's just...